Yeah, I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just catapulting towards some greater purpose?
With bloated ego, we are the only DJ crazy enough to tattoo Jackie Brown on his ass.
This is Michael Mann, and I ride with
extended clip.
I'm available for calls.
Yeah, I'm available. Who knows when opportunities knocking or calling?
I'll take a call.
Yeah.
See, I am not going to let people call me on Twitter or Instagram or anything, or just like post my phone number, because that's the allure of the call-in show when we do this.
True.
You know?
Yeah.
If people can just call me anytime or just DM me anytime, that like takes away. So that's also a new thing. Like, if you want to DM me like a question or something, like don't do that anymore. Like, I've always been nice about that, you know? Don't do that anymore. Just email and it'll be right on the show. That's what that's for. You know, that's now the only way to ask me a question, even if it's, where did you download this?
Even if you're a close personal friend of the show, too. Yes. You've got all inquiries through email now.
No more private interactions, all right? Yeah. Those are too gold. We're going to have to start using those. So
if you really know me, you can text me. You know, like, I'm not going to read, you know, do you want to meet up at the store on the podcast?
Do you want to go to the store later? We're going to meet up at the store, yeah. We're going to meet up at the grocery store later. We're going to
this is a week old by now, but yeah. I can't make it is my answer. I'm a little bit, I was a little bit busy a week ago. So, yeah, sorry, but maybe next week.
It's good to have advanced warning. You can, you know, sign up for whatever rewards program is valid at that grocery store and clip your coupons of choice, you know. Go into the grocery store with a purpose. Not like these lollygaggers I see out there, you know. Welcome to Extended Clip. It is episode 289. I am one of your hosts, Eddie Averill.
I'm Malcolm Baum.
I'm JT White.
And today we are talking about a film from Adam Egoyan from 1994 from the strange, strange land of Toronto, Canada. This is a film called Exotica. And if you didn't know how weird it was and how weird this filmmaker is, his name isn't spelt like the first man, but A-T-O-M, because this guy is like a nuclear physicist of cinema.
That's interesting, because I feel like that's not really his reputation of being like the weird,
the
this guy's
mad
a wacko
scientist. Yeah.
This guy's the mad scientist of cinema. What's Atom cooking up, you know, today? Yeah.
I actually did not even realize his name was spelt like that until I saw directed by, like, in the credits. I always just thought it was Adam. Like, he was just a guy, you know?
Now he's something else to me. He's like a sideshow.
Exactly.
Of my name.
Malcolm, you picked this movie. I want to ask you why, but also I want to ask, did it make you think of another one of your favorites, Go-Go Tales? Was that part of the selection process?
You know, I guess I'd never really thought of those two movies together, although it's kind of obvious in their similarities being centered around a strip club, Exotica and Go-Go Tales. That's an interesting, you know, comparison, kind of almost like a depression versus enlightenment, right, with Go-Go Girls and Exotica. I don't know. I guess why I chose it, I remember I'd seen this movie before, and there's just certain scenes that kind of stuck with me, and I felt that I kind of maybe underrated it a little bit on first watch. Like, I thought it had a lot of, in my mind, just potential for my appreciation to go up on a rewatch. And I also, like, a year ago, I watched another Egoyan film called The Sweet Hereafter, which focuses on like a smaller town recovering after like a school bus crashed and killed a bunch of kids. You know what I mean? Everyone's kind of dealing with the trauma from that. And I like that one a good amount. So I don't know. Yeah, I just wanted to bring this movie to the podcast just because it feels very unique, you know. And I feel like, you know, I kind of like this Adam Egoyan guy. I don't know. I think that these might be his most acclaimed movies that I just named, you know, Exotica and The Sweet Hereafter. You know, maybe there's, I don't know how deep the filmography is, but I don't know. I just think he has an interesting depressive quality to him that's obviously on display in Exotica. And I don't know. It's just, I thought we could sink our teeth into this movie. I feel like there's some angles for us here.
Oh, there's definitely some angles. I think like the signature, well, really the signature shot of the movie is looking out into the main floor of the strip club where everyone's getting their private dances with this two-way mirror, like interrogation style, where the staff gets to watch and, you know, peep on these guys getting their rocks off. And the kind of chain of voyeurism and desire and everything through the people who work at the club, the people who frequent the club, and the people on the outside looking in, it's this strange, you know, linkage of all of these people through, you know, the sleaziest means possible. I mean, yeah, our pet store owner is only linked up with our very traumatized protagonist because of their lines of work in the IRS and a money laundering front, respectively. But it is also just like, it's going to be perversity that's going to link them together, truly, you know. And I really like this film as just a Goyen's vision of a society that's based around desire, especially with the metaphor at the center being the look but don't touch rule of the strip club, where it's like the whole society seems to be built around that, where no one actually has what they want. It's all just about the endless supply of desire. And yeah, I found that to be great because it also turns very depressing when that desire also manifests within like family-based trauma and stuff like that, and not just pure sex and greed. JT, how'd you like this movie?
I took to it as well. This feels like not for the sexual nature of the content. I wouldn't associate that with our dear friend Malcolm, but this feels like a classic Malcolm pick to me. Just something that I think you go for a lot of things that are just like unlike anything else. Like, this is a very distinctive, like, I hate to get too general, but like atmosphere and mood. And that's something that, especially the depressive nature, not that Malcolm is a depressive, but like this film, I feel like right away, just sort of like feeling it out, like going into movies that are heavy with like desire and sex, I anticipate something like a little bit more high energy. But this, just, I don't know, there's a lot of just like leering and looking, and it took me by surprise. And I love, I don't know, so much of the set design in this is beautiful and like elaborate, like especially like the strip club. Like, I mean, it's the name of the movie, Exotica. And then of course, like, I don't know, the club itself is very intense.
It's like a Rainforest Cafe strip club. Yeah. where they play 80s Leonard Cohen songs. You know, it's one of the most Canadian things imaginable.
No, all of Canada's stars are here. You have future acclaimed director Sarah Polley is there.
Is Elias Koteas Canadian? Is he like a Canadian Greek or something like that?
He is Canadian. Bruce Greenwood's Canadian. Mm-hmm. Everyone here, it's a Canadian
Bruce
suck and fuck
Greenwood's
fest.
Like the fucking Canadian Robert Redford.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, so this movie, if you don't know Bruce Greenwood's character, you could kind of start with him and slowly move out, because it doesn't deliver exposition in the way a traditional movie does. It's, as Egoyan said, structured like a striptease, where you learn about the dark, traumatic past slowly. It all gets unveiled throughout the course of the song or movie, which, you know, it's a little bit of a jerk-off metaphor, but I'll allow it from Mr. Egoyan here. But if, with hindsight looking back at it, yeah, his character, Francis, is this, I don't know what they're called in Canada, but in America, the IRS agent, like a tax collector type guy, who is investigating this bird shop that has a big smuggling problem. And he also has a dead wife and child. He was implicated in the murder of his child, and he is a very traumatized man who, you know, uses a form of self-prescribed therapy, that is going to the strip club and having a way too intense staring contest with one of the dancers night after night, who is introduced as the elusive schoolgirl over and over by Elias Koteas as DJ Eric. Sounds much more like a skater, dude. You know, like, what's up, man? I'm DJ Eric. I love schoolgirls and rock and roll.
He could have used a hobby like skating, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He might have improved his life. He wouldn't have got so caught up at work. You know, I got to separate work and play.
Only $5. That's right. $5 is all it takes to have one of our beautiful foxes come over to your table and get you all hot and bothered. But hey, why be bothered when you're being treated like a king? You've had a rough day. Don't you think you owe it to yourselves to do something that'll make you feel like you're someone special? You are someone special. $5 is all it takes to prove it.
But I also love the first like 30 minutes of this movie. You're not really sure what the relationships are, and like it's almost implied that Eric and the owner of the club are the parents of this schoolgirl dancer, Christine, like, until, you know, some sexual stuff gets implied. Owner is like a mother figure, and the DJ, Eric, is a past lover. And it's a complicated relationship, and I really love how vague this whole film is for the first hour or so, and then once all the pieces finally are set in place, you can finally, you know, go off and have more of a crime thriller type third act. But it's very, you know, oblique getting there, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting, like, looking at the advertising for this movie, like, it's sold as, like, an erotic thriller, you know what I mean? Or, like, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, great erotic thrillers released around like late 80s, early 90s, and this is released like mid 90s. It's kind of what Eddie was getting at after earlier, the concept of the strip club, you know, look, can't touch. And so like you have these kind of tortured relationships that you kind of see at the beginning, like thinking of the strip club and kind of like DJ Eric's position. You know, I feel like we spend a lot of time with him up top at the beginning as we kind of overlook and observe and kind of see everything that's going on. And I have to say, Egoyan's really good at like visually enhancing the mood, whether it's kind of like the oblique, less story description beginning, or, you know, when things get a little bit more tense, you know, towards the back end of the movie, you know, something that's literally, you know, the intensity is explicitly said by the main character, you know, wears his intensity on his sleeve in kind of an intense way, in a not a comfortable way. But before the movie kind of gets into it, like, I just kind of like the idea of like the strip club DJ kind of pontificating about the strippers as they perform, being like, what makes a schoolgirl so attractive? Is it the innocence or whatever?
He's so dramatic.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny. It, like, if you were to walk in there, be like, this place has like horrendous vibes. Like, we need to go to a different place. Like, definitely very cool looking. A lot of budget spent on the foliage that we get in a nice tracking shot at the beginning.
Yeah, we're dipping the strip clubs too ethereal.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you'd be able to tell, like, oh, damn, I feel like people are working through traumas here. I think I better get out of here. Just the way the story moves and how information's revealed is just very interesting in this movie.
And I really love it. Speaking to that opening hour, I love the third, like, Thomas's story. His character is probably like one of my favorites. I just love how he fits in there, like this scheme that you sort of see him wind up doing for
where
the
it's
first,
like, this weird economy of free opera tickets and cruising.
Yes. And not even like successfully. I mean, towards the tail end, he's like actually making moves. But I feel like I don't know if there's the implication is that he has been having sex with these men. But for the most part, he's just staring at their cocks during the opera.
Yeah.
And it's just
given,
so
just given
funny.
A tent check.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I think you're right, JT. I don't think he is, like, I think only till the third guy.
Yeah.
He gets to sleep with the men because, you know, at when we first see him do that, he kind of walks away abruptly at the end of the night.
Yeah,
such an interesting character, because a lot of movies like that, that's like enough, right? Where that we have like kind of this introverted gay guy
who owns like a pet store too. Like, yeah, it's insane. Well,
that's what I'm saying. Like in most movies, like this introverted guy kind of discovering his sexuality would be enough, but there's like this espionage subplot or whatever, where like the guy he sleeps with, working with Francis the agent, and like, you know, he confiscates the foreign bird eggs that he's smuggling, which
and he just has this apartment that's bare with like two CD towers that are covered in plastic, and then this expensive hyper futuristic high-tech egg fertilizer unit, you know, that's like definitely worth more than anything else in the building combined. And it's just such a strange dynamic. It's like, all right, he's a weird exotic animal guy. And that's just, you know, one tiny ingredient of the movie. And I love how dense the movie goes from there. You know, like it's every character is that dense. And so you go back to Francis, and it's very vaguely introducing his relationship with this young teen girl played by future iconic female filmmaker Sarah Pauli. At first, it's like, what the fuck? Is this some sort of like Taxi Driver relationship here, where this 14-year-old girl's getting out of his car, getting dropped off, and he's paying her? But it turns out that he is still paying her as a babysitter like he used to. And it's his way of, again, working through the trauma of losing his family. And finally, it's revealed that this girl, the schoolgirl dancer at the core of this whole story, was also part of that traumatic loss that he suffered, and was, you know, part of that family in an extended, you know, friend of the family way, as we see him drop her off at a very final flashback. And I know I'm going very out of order narratively here, but it really slowly bleeds out into this kind of everything is connected narrative that I think if it tried to establish that too early on in the movie, it would be too like overly coincidence bound and everything like that, and be obviously too, you know, grandiose, I guess, in its attempts. But the way that he Egoyan, that is, just like sneakily drips out all of this information throughout the 100 minutes or so is really skillful, and it's a very innovative way of weaving a tale there, you know. And I think the visual style is very much an appropriate accompaniment too. It's like this lurid style of storytelling is matched with slow camera movements and a lot of still frames, nothing too like zippy and showy, but all very masterfully composed and very highly textured, and just feels very much taking in all the sensations that you're seeing there in the style. And I really like that. It feels like I forgot who wrote this in a review, but they described the camera feeling like a missing character from the movie trying to get into it. And it really does have a voyeuristic feeling to the camera direction.
Yeah.
I'd love to look up who said that, because it completely left my mind. I was like, oh, that was a great quote. Who the fuck was that?
We would love to pay them.
Well, I don't know about that.
just a light joke. What's interesting about this movie is we have like Eric and Francis, you know, Eric the DJ, and all these people who are kind of caught up in like the past and like memories of who they were, you know, kind of being unable to let go, and kind of, you know, by ending the movie with like kind of like the memory that makes it all fall into place is, yeah, it's just a very intelligent move for this like emotional movie, you know, that really like in addition to, you know, its visual prowess and not puzzle piece storyline, but kind of, yeah, like it's just a revealing of a picture, I guess. But the mood is so great too, because it is like, yeah, every character just has you could feel the sadness that they carry, or, you know, their frustration. Like thinking of small moments, like kind of like Sarah Pauli's father in this movie, the weird interaction that Francis has with that, and kind of, you know, obviously this weird relationship. It seems like you know, nothing sexual is going on, but at the same time, you know, with the reveal at the ending, it's like some sort of weird tortured pathology of the father just allowing to continue, and kind of like it's implicated, right, that that's his brother, right, that he's dealing with, the Francis character, or do they just call each other brothers?
I think they just call each other that. Okay. I think they're just friends. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, I mean, you know, close friends, brother, either yeah, way, yeah, yeah, like yeah. kind of, I don't
so
know.
Someone in his immediate vicinity. Yeah.
Just the strangeness of like profiting off of your friends, like
yeah.
psychotic trauma in which they take your daughter to play piano at your house every day, and kind of, how that's like addressed when Sarah Pauly and the Francis character talk to each other. And I don't know, it just does a good job of really enhancing, you know, what they feel. And just one scene I wanted to mention that's just kind of funny and just crazy is when Eric convinces Francis to touch the Mira Kushner character in the bathroom. I mean, yeah, it's one of the most visually impressive parts of the movie, because you have that great interplay of Francis in the stall and Eric outside in the bathroom. And I mean, you know, just our alley, you know, the reason we have this podcast, isn't it funny that he uses like a Puerto Rican accent to convince him to like, it's like, oh no, man, like you gotta touch her, she'll be into it. Or whatever.
Yeah.
And for some reason that, like, you could tell that convinces Francis a little bit more than it would otherwise, yeah. you know.
Just workshopping in his mind which accent, which voice. Like, what is
I gotta
the most
change
convincing?
I can't fully do the DJ voice, but I can have the kind of DJ swag if I do a very light Puerto Rican type voice.
Hey, why don't you give her a little touch, huh?
You're not supposed to touch.
Oh, but she is into it, believe me. Yeah.
How do you know?
Everybody knows, man. Trust me, my friend. Trust me, just a little touch. Nothing too drastic. Then you will get the full experience, my friend.
The visual approach of that scene is really great too. Yeah, Malcolm, as you said, like, one character is kind of roaming around the bathroom by the sinks and stuff, and one is locked into the stall, and then eventually you have that one really well-staged shot that has both of them playing with the mirror on top of the stall, and that leads to the Francis character just touching her to find out. He's like, what happens when I touch her, you know? And it's the whole, like, thesis and big themes of the movie coming to a head, you know, about desire and unsatisfaction and unsatisfaction in life. And he finally does touch her, and he just gets his ass kicked and thrown out of the club. And then he decides, all right, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to put a wire on this pet store guy who I'm auditing, and I'm going to make him do the same thing, but have him ask about me too, which is like some real high school, like if a high schooler was a fucking special agent, you know? And so they go through this super immature thing, and like, it doesn't even work out how he wanted it to. Like, the guy that he fought with before, DJ Eric, is just like chilling in the parking lot waiting for him. And all of these kind of like final showdowns at the end are just stalemates between like the four lead characters here. And it then goes back to that flashback that places Christine, the Mira Kirshner character, within the past of Francis. And yeah, I really think that this film works as just like a microcosm of a society. Like, it has this like perfect circle storytelling with all of its flashbacks and slowly revealed information. But I love that it's like implied that this is a very specific story to, even though it never even says Toronto in the movie, it's very clearly a Toronto movie. And it feels like any city in the world, you're going to have some sort of really weird, lurid economy of trauma like this that might be based around a different idiosyncratic club like this, you know? And I'm not saying there should be a spin-off like Exotica New Orleans, you know? Alex Ross Perry presents Exotica Brooklyn.
for male widowers only, you know.
Yeah, exactly. As far as the male widower movie goes, yeah, this one, it doesn't paint a very convincing picture. You know, you guys, you got to keep your wives alive. You can't be living convincing like this, picture.
Yeah, like
of just like a normal adjusted life. Like, it doesn't seem possible. You got to keep that wife alive,
buddy. Yeah, having the wife die seems like a total loss. Like, you gotta
can't think of a movie where it becomes normal. You know, John Wick, that guy goes crazy.
True. We need like a Rodney Dangerfield 80s style comedy where like a guy wife's dies. He's like, this is the best day of my life. My annoying wife is, there's probably something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he has to like overcome some sort of obstacle to inherit her family's money or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then but of course at the end he's like, oh, actually I miss my wife.
Yeah, it's sad that she, that can't happen. But, he needs to be happy without the wife.
And then Brian Doyle Murray is like, you know, you always were a good son to me.
JT, I agree, but it has to be like a light, just being like, yeah, actually, it's bad that she died, but I have a new wife. I don't really think about the old wife that much, but it was bad that that happened. Not the lesson learned here. In fact, it seems like, I don't know, it'll ruin your life. I hope no one...
Yeah.
Not to...
No one with a dead wife is listening to this.
Exactly.
Well, if you are, that means you proved us wrong. Like, you are truly, like, a great person for
persevering. They've shut off the podcast by this point. If there's a widower...
Yeah.
You need a content warning for widowers in the episode description.
Why is that the only time I've ever thought that before? Like, you know what I mean? Like, having empathy like that. I don't know why it... You know, maybe that's how convincing the movie
is. You kind of do carry yourself like a widower.
True. Vocal. Well, I have the same hair as fucking Eric from the movie, unfortunately. I was true. Like, damn, I might need a cut. But Elias Koteas, you know, I feel like people consider him an attractive guy. You know, not the most attractive personality in this movie, but...
yeah.
So if I'm looking... Yeah.
You should never tell people who they look like, but if someone told you, hey, you kind of look like Elias Koteas, you wouldn't take that too hardly, would you?
No, totally. That would be like,
he's
high
a movie
end.
Star. Yeah.
That's definitely high. That would be like top three I've gotten in terms of celebrity comparisons, to be honest. But I'm not Greek.
I only get bad ones. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be punk rock. You know, I don't want to be like a celebrity anyways. You know,
exactly. So, you look like that guy, Glenn Danzig.
Actually, the best one I've gotten is the dude from Typo Negative when my hair was really long. And I'm like, dude, hell yeah. some like 60-year-old dude. I was actually pretty hyped on that.
Was that on the set of Free LSD?
No, actually on NCIS.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah, my work people just compare me to old balding men, and it really kind of hurts my feelings.
I feel like we've discussed this. Scorsese's hilarious.
Yeah, the Scorsese one's bad
because you don't look like him at all.
Yeah, you're not short either. Yeah, it
doesn't make any sense at all. But it's just such a funny guy to be.
Jack Nicholson in The Shining. I've been getting, which I really don't like. That's rough. Yeah,
you look like Cot Nicholson in the 70s, dude. You look like the, when Nicholson was the man.
Was a piece of ass.
Yeah.
No, that's the thing, because like Jack Nicholson, obviously, that's a fucking movie star. Like, if you're going to compare someone to someone, like a movie star, like that's the, you know, that's the thing. Like, I don't think you should compare someone to anyone unless you're like, oh, you kind of look like, you know, Brad Pitt, you know.
Yeah.
Like, that's, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, but I can't be complaining about Jack Nicholson. I just know that the only there's only a few reasons why this person is zeroing in on me as Jack Torrance. And they're not the qualities that made Jack Nicholson a major star and a sex icon, even.
Yeah. No, exactly. These middling comparisons are not. We could read in between the lines, you know. Yeah. We know what's going on.
Malcolm, you know who you look like?
Oh no! See, I'm bracing myself for it. Yeah. No, it's okay. Did you have one? It's okay. You
no, I wasn't. I was just trying to think of something in the meantime. I was going to say maybe like Charles Laughton or something like that.
That's like middle of the pack. Like I at this point, I'd be willing to take that. I think the longer hair I get, less comparisons. I don't know. Maybe it's like. I don't know. We don't need to talk about me.
We do not need to talk about you. I'm not important. No, you're not. Just kidding. You are. Exotica, I think it's a great film. I'm going to go 4 bullets. It made me want to go back to Toronto. What about you, JT?
I'm going to go 3.5 bullets. I really liked it, but it took me a minute to get on its wavelength. It's one of those where I feel like it's going to grow with time for me. Mm-hmm. I feel like we talked about this like a few months ago, just leaving space in the rating for it to either just to like fill out the director's filmography or to return something.
Would you say it's a grower, not a shower?
No, I would not say that.
Those are kind of like the comparisons you get. Like, it sounds kind of nice, but you know what that really means. You know
But there are a lot of like very weird specific details about this that I love. Like, I don't know, the wiretapping someone to go to a strip club is so awesome of a detail. And then the like DJ Eric meeting Christina at like a search party.
Yeah.
Like that's a great place to pick up a chick. And he looks like he has like is he wearing like a David Foster Wallace style headband?
It does seem like he doesn't have a bandana.
He's
got the tied hair. Yeah. It's not full on like robber thug bandana, you know, but like it's more of an athletic bandana, I feel like. But yeah, it's a cool look he's got going there. It's almost quasi professorial.
Yeah, no. So if you want to meet some new people, I don't know, and do some good too. Go join a search party.
Go join a strip club. Yep.
No, if you're trying to get those steps in, you know, I always love a good search party. Always good to stay at light. No, it's funny, like JT, I feel like your reaction is kind of like the first reaction I had to the movie, and those scenes of them searching at the search party is just something that stuck in my mind. I think it's because it contrasts so well with like the gray and blue color scheme of the strip club.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like most of the time when they'd flash back to the search party, like it's after a scene at the strip club for like 10 minutes, you just have these open fields. And ironically, you know, it's the most like traditionally like beautiful image of the movies when they're at the search party. And I don't know, I kind of like, I've never seen these movies, but like, I imagine, you know, when Kateas and Kirshner are talking, that's like before sunset vibes or whatever, you know what I mean? Like kind of, I like their kind of youthful conversation that they have while searching for Francis's daughter. But yeah, I'm going to give it 4 bullets, and, you know, it grew on me. And the mood that this movie brings is just so particular and kind of woozy. Like it's kind of like, it gets kind of overwhelmingly sad at points, especially, I mean, the Francis character, I mean, you know, one of the saddest characters of all time. No happiness on the screen whatsoever for poor old Francis. So, I don't know. It just, it's uniqueness and it's, the depth of characters and kind of its setting, I don't know, it just sets it apart, and it just makes me want to watch more Egoyan movies. You know, I don't know if I want to go to Toronto. All these Canadian movies, you know, I watch them. They're never about how Canada's like cool or like fun to go to, or I don't know what's up there. I only know Canada through like Cronenberg, Egoyan, and I guess Drake. Drake might be a representative of Canada, but kind of seems like a scary, sad place. I don't know. Maybe I'd go to Vancouver. It seems a little bit sunnier.
Canada's for sad, twisted lovers.
Yeah, you could go to Vancouver, hang out with Nardwar.
Yeah, you know, I'll take that over Francis. I don't know. I don't know if I want to hang out with Francis crying at the strip club. But I get why. I get why he doesn't.
Exactly. All right, we'll be right back on Extended Clip.
That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich.
Malcolm hanging out with Nardwar.
how it goes.
It's just sticking with me. Yeah. Very funny.
I
just
need like him
having listened to every extended clip episode beforehand.
Is Nardwar bringing Malcolm like a Walmart DVD of some weird horror movie he mentioned 200 episodes?
Brings out a copy of the Harsh Noise album I made when I was 15. Like, oh, we're fans of, I listen to this. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, like a CDR copy of a mixtape that you wrote a review of when you were 15.
True. My teenage archives. Yeah. If anyone wants to dig those up, there's a lot there. I think on Twitter, someone I was friend, or I don't know if you found it, Eddie, but like someone found like a Drake review I did when I was like 14 or 15. That was pretty
nice.
Like, the writing in that was pretty hilarious. Like, pretty funny to look back.
I'm sure.
You know, this is that time of the afternoon, the 5-hour energy drink commercial. They said, oh, you know, it's that end of day push. You know, you just need that burst of energy to get you through.
No, that 5-hour energy pitch is perfect because it's, I just power load in the mornings, like
makes sense.
Or four shots of espresso right away. And then I'm like, why am I always so fucking tired at like 3 or 4 in the afternoon? Why do I need a nap now?
True. You're drinking straight from the tap, you know, working with coffee. Like that is just having unlimited access. I would do the same. Like I would go way too hard
tight.
At the beginning.
I love being able to have like it for free. It like during my days off. I mean, I definitely still go to coffee shops because I feel like it's easier to do work outside of the house, or like just sometimes like on my day off, I don't want to be just sitting at home on my laptop. But like, I don't know. I get this shit for free. I don't need to like have it out and about elsewhere.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. When I'd work, you know, on set, like on NCIS, I would like I'd load up on snacks like every day and just bring them home or whatever, or, you know, just
I know that. I was on a music video for a friend recently, Nico and I, we were talent. And so I just like got to have the experience of like sitting around just eating snacks all day, just reading, loading up on snacks to take home with me. I mean, it was kind of a pain in the ass because I had to do some puppetry at one point. My ass was very sore because I had to like be like squatting like down with my hand up, like to keep, because I'm like, I don't know, maybe not the best puppeteer because I'm so tall, but like I was like had to be like discreetly kind of out of frame for it. And like the next day it was just like my haunches and my ass were so sore.
The one time you feel for the actors is like whenever they have to do like a take in like some uncomfortable position and they have to like do it over and over again. It's just like that's fucking annoying, you know.
But I feel like that's few and far between. Most of the positional, like, actors are in very safe, comfortable positions most of the time.
Usually a nice stand or a sit.
Yeah, nice stand or a sit, exactly.
I forgot about, or I feel like I didn't forget, but I was maybe like a month or two ago somehow, maybe it was just on the timeline again, but you in that music video, kind of like that being like a viral moment. I don't know. I just saw that again. I was like, that's great. That's just, I don't know.
No,
I just love to see that.
I'm hoping for round two. milking this one again. I mean, it's some shitty like Australian band, I think. I don't know what this is. I mean, not like the other, obviously the other song was really bad. It was like the original one was like a band with like all like four white guys, and the name of the song was Motown, and it was about eating pussy. It's just like a classic recipe for disaster.
I didn't pick up on the song being about eating pussy.
No, I didn't like metaphor. I mean because my buddy was the guy who directed it, and he was like, yeah, apparently they said like it's about eating pussy, and I was like, there's one line where they say something about going down. I think they rhyme that with Motown. And it's just like
that classic
on.
Motown sound.
They
was just Australian guys talking about eating pussy?
No, that was the video I was in like right before I left LA.
Okay.
The new one is some Australian group. I don't know.
About doing normal stuff. No pussy metaphors.
No pussy. Ugh.
Yeah, kangaroos. Yeah.
Shrimp on the barbie.
We got some rays, got some barbies.
Yeah. Marmite. Things you like.
Marmite.
Vegemite? Is it Marmite? No, Vegemite.
Vegemite.
I guess they got both over there, right? I don't know.
It's bad. It sounds horrible.
Yeah.
What are numbers like in Australia?
Not very good. I mean, they're not very good anywhere, honestly. Australia is like, we have some because Australia is an English-speaking nation, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like Australians like edgy content. I think we need to be like more
edgy. Freedom of speech is illegal there. So they're not allowed to say insert sound effect here. I've been bleeping myself with the crashing glass sound effect lately, which I like. It's a good touch.
What have you been saying? You've been bleeping yourself a lot?
Not a lot. I know you guys don't listen to the podcast back, but once in a while, if I don't want to cut something out completely, I'll just bleep the actual bad part so there's a little bit of guesswork, you know?
Sometimes I'll play the podcast back just because I was like, oh, man. If we haven't hung out in a while, I'll be like, wow, I miss hanging out with the guys.
You know what? I take back what I say. Australia, at least on one, on SoundCloud alone, in the last month, Australia did surpass Canada as our number three country.
Shit. Yeah, wow. Yeah,
but the thing is, like, I think SoundCloud has bad metrics because I feel like everything else is going to say otherwise. But because, like, Toronto is still one of our top cities, you know. Those metrics lie, in my opinion.
Yeah, no. Next pitch is to do, like, George Miller movies. Oh, or God.
Yeah, you got to do George Miller. We love George Miller. They got to do heaps George Miller episodes.
Is that guy, is Richard Stanley Australian? Or did he just make some movies there?
Michael Winner? Isn't he? That's a guy,
Michael
right?
Winner.
Sick fucking name.
Is he the guy who did Death Wish?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
He's Australian?
I think so. Yeah.
Good for him.
Oh, Richard Stanley is South African.
Oh, same thing. The same thing. I'm not gonna put
similar some glass accents over that one.
Similar.
Michael Winner is British.
Michael Winner, same thing. The same thing.
Well, I mean, a little bit more truthful in that context, right?
Yeah.
Because Australia, its origin and what?
Yeah, Australia, according to iTunes, is fourth. It is behind Canada still, so you know. It's not that big of a deal.
I feel like Australia doesn't get a lot of credit for its origins. They kind of came from tough beginnings. I don't know.
They did come from tough beginnings. Bart Simpson did prank the mayor of Australia, and they've been recovering ever since.
Yeah.
It was a really historical, traumatic time for a lot of people. They ended up having to reverse the way the toilets flushed, and everybody had to learn knifey spoony, even in England. You know, it was weird.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to pour out in the future, or we're going to do our Michael Winner Richard Stanley retrospective.
Almost Australians retrospective. That sounds pretty good, to be honest. Yeah.
Almost Australian.
I think Winner made like a movie in Australia. Maybe that's why I thought he was Australian.
Is, you know who I think is Australian? Is the guy who did Link, Richard Franklin.
That's who I was thinking of. Yeah. That's who I was thinking of when JT was saying Richard Stanley. I was thinking that as well.
Because I know Road Games is Australian.
Road Games.
Link was sick.
I keep trying to do an accent and it doesn't work at all. Like, I've done other voices, but then that one just like doesn't go from brain to mouth. I can't do it. I can only say George Miller.
I like the rabidness in which you say George Miller. They're frothing at the mouth for some George Miller. Accents are I can only do them like when I'm not thinking about it. You know, if I think about it, then I can't do it.
Exactly. If I think about it, I can't do it. Sounds like a line from the next movie we're going to talk about. But we are back on Extended Cliff. We're talking about Australians. Have you guys seen Baz Luhrmann's Australia? And is Baz Luhrmann Australia?
I think he is.
I did see. I saw
Baz Luhrmann.
I saw Australia in theaters.
Baz is an absolute fucking Australian name. The Bosmanian devil.
It's a nickname.
Oh, it is?
Mark Anthony Baz. In quotations.
His name is Mark Anthony? Like the dude who dated J-Lo?
What's Boz short?
Yeah, how do you get Boz out of that? He just really liked Boz Skaggs.
That, I was going to say,
Boz.
Boz Skaggs, what a sick name. Was he Australian? Almost Australian?
Everyone with a weird name. Are they Australian Luhrmann or do they just have a bad name?
Received the nickname Boz at school, given to him because of his hairstyle, the name coming from the puppet character Basil Brush.
Basil, I really thought when you said hair, I was like, was it because of Boz Skaggs?
I thought maybe it was like, you know how people say Paws? You know what I mean? I thought maybe it was like that, but Boz.
Because Baz Luhrmann was doing gay shit, like his movies, since he was in elementary school. And they were like, yo, Boz with that shit. Like,
that's how they say Boz in Australia.
Yeah. Boz. 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 No Luhrmann. I don't know. I'm being still British. Yeah, no, no Luhrmann.
Yeah,
I won't
enough.
Do a voice. Boz. No Luhrmann.
Almost Australian is a good concept. I'm going to carry that with me.
I feel like there's like a record label or something called Secretly Canadian, and I feel like Almost Australian, if you founded that, you could become like sister companies with them, you know? Like you could absolutely hit a collab.
I might get into Australian culture. You know, I don't know. Yeah. I think I might.
Well, as you said, they did have a really tough start, so. You know.
Exactly. I respect that.
Oh boy. But we are back, as I said earlier, on Extended Clip. It is Malcolm in the Middle. Malcolm is across from me on the computer here. I wish he was across from me in person again, but we can only dream. Malcolm, what have you been doing out in beautiful, sunny, not 40 degree Santa Clarita?
Well, it was raining this past weekend, you know, so it's not all sunshine and roses, you know.
See, I didn't even care when it rained in California because I have a car, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, I have to walk from my car to the door of somewhere in the rain. Now I'm fucked. I hate it.
Yeah.
Expecting to carry an umbrella?
You can invest in a poncho.
I got a poncho and rain poncho, a pant poncho.
Ooh, pant poncho.
I got rain pants.
Okay, rain pants. That's not really. I was like pants poncho, like just.
It's the same material as the.
Just pants poncho is like a poncho, yeah. But like the dick is hanging out of where the head would be. That's with the pants poncho.
You should get the whole like get up with like the yellow raincoat, rain pants, boots.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Singing in the rain style,
like Paddington Bear.
Yeah. Like... That'd be pretty sick. But you're right. It is cool when it rains in California because it doesn't happen that often. So I did enjoy it.
That's why they wrote that song, I'm Only Happy When It Rains.
Exactly, you know, because I'm not crying anymore. But Sunday, I went to church, you know. I had a change of faith. And I put my knees down in the altar. But I didn't go to a Catholic church. I went to the Church of Cinema, and I saw...
got down on your knees. And you
put your knees down in the altar.
Sucked off a projectionist. Yeah.
During the previews, I kneeled, and then I sat when the movie started. But I saw Immaculate, the new nun horror movie starring Sydney Sweeney, who's gets a lot of press these days. She's very popular.
Yeah.
There's been a huge push for her, especially in the past, like, 3 months, it feels like. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe I'm not going to call it manufactured consent or anything, because you don't got to manufacture that, you know?
Well, Eddie, you're much like the misogynist Italian cops in Immaculate that see Sydney Sweeney in a nun uniform, and they say in Italian, oh, what a waste, you know? Because what's a girl like her going to be a nun for, right? You could agree or disagree to that if you want, But Immaculate, right? It's, I feel like, in addition to Sydney Sweeney, it was, I feel like they were like, oh, this is like a bloody mess. Like, this is a bloody movie. And to be honest, I guess, you know, just to quickly review it, it is, it's a little bit better than your average horror fare, you know? But at the same time, it kind of, you know, with the Sydney Sweeney and the violence, I still kind of was stuck in that nun horror movie trap. These nun church-based horror movies are kind of boring. I don't, I mean, obviously, you could think of some examples that are not the case, like The Devils, of course, you know, but, you know, that's like so different than, you know, a mainstream horror movie being released in 2024. And, like, I think there's kind of, like, a twist in this kind of, I guess, not from your average nun movie. It kind of has, like, a modernist angle towards the ending. Like, the ending kind of goes against, like, the teachings of the Catholic Church, you know. So I guess if you're a real devout guy, that might upset you. There are, like, certain accents. Like, I feel like the movie kind of begins well. Like, we kind of have a nun character that we don't see at the beginning of the movie, but she tries to escape, like, the monastery, and, like, these creepy nuns capture her and whatnot. And that was kind of cool. But once you kind of get into the normal pace of the movie, it just kind of felt standard. And then there occasionally would be a scene, you know, like, they have some torture devices at this church, you know what I mean? They're trying to silence some dissidents to kind of reveal this major plan, and kind of, I guess the big crux of the movie is that Sydney Sweeney is believed to be impregnated by God. The second coming of Jesus, you know, is in her womb, and it's revealed that maybe that's not the case throughout the movie. So it's, I don't know, I guess the way I'm talking about it, I don't really have much insightful to say, and it's just kind of a standard horror movie that's maybe a little bit better because of certain scenes. Things get scary, I guess it gets a little bit better, but I don't know, I'm kind of bored by these non-horror movies.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, if Verhoeven couldn't even make it that good, you know.
I like, obviously, that one. That I like
that one's above the cut. Yeah, that's not just a Blumhouse horror movie or whatever.
But you're right. Like, that wasn't like, you know, I mean, it's hard to compare.
It was the weaker of, I thought it was the weakest of his recent, like, fictional movies, at least, which it's not like he's pumping them out, but I definitely prefer, like, L.
Yeah, no, L, I really fuck with
L. L really, I mean, maybe L is an outlier because the guy worked in Hollywood for so long, but L felt like the best of both worlds. We're like, he got to indulge the way he did in Hollywood, but admittedly, you know, taking a budget cut, but, you know, then also with the respectability of the French art house world. And, you know, L, maybe I didn't think it was a masterpiece when it came out, but, man, we got to go back to that one. I think
That's
enough
awesome.
Time has passed where it's like, what is it, 8 years or so since it came out, you know? Like, I feel like it's time to give that one its proper due sometime because... Yeah.
That actually seems like a really good idea. We should do an episode on now. But yeah, this one, I don't know. It's not like, it's not sleazy. It's not, it's just, it's more like that your standard horror movie being released today, Immaculate. And I feel like the advertising was kind of like, oh, we're a little bit more extreme. And it's like,
I hear there's some Giallo influence.
It's, I mean, a little bit. It's,
I read on Letterboxd that there's a character named Dr. Gialli. I also read that on IMDb. Yes.
Oh.
See, I didn't even pick up on, you know, that, you know, I'm just like, oh, that's an Italian name. But it's like, that's like Giallo. Yeah. So Jason Blum, if you're listening, you know, step the game up.
Wait, so was this one Blumhouse?
I don't think so, no.
You call every new horror movie a Blumhouse movie.
That's the thing, Blum.
You need to tweet at him about this one, be like, Jason Blum, a little disappointed by Immaculate.
Blum, here's the issue. You're the face of horror movies in Hollywood now. If any bad horror movie is released, it's on you. We're blaming you, Jason Blum. So I don't know what to tell you.
This one was from Black Bear Pictures, 50-50 Films, Lupin Films. No one huge, producing a couple co-producers. Coming together, got picked up by whatever distributor it got. But not Blumhouse.
It is like, it's mostly set in the convent, so I could see it kind of being a cheaper movie, something that they made on the fly. So credit to the producers, they'll make their money back.
Well, Sidney Sweeney was a producer on this.
True. And that's a business lesson to young women out there.
And we're back. I didn't really need to go back to a break there for any reason. JT, did you watch anything good on the last week or so since we last recorded?
Yeah, I watched something like kind of good.
Okay,
I feel
noteworthy.
Like, yeah, noteworthy. I kind of it speaks to a genre much like Malcolm was talking about nun movies. This is like a 70s exploitation women in prison movie. And that's a genre that I feel like is generally, like, even when you're in the dregs of, like, women in prison, especially during the heyday, like, of exploitation stuff, you're going to enjoy what you see. And this was The Big Dollhouse by Jack Hill, who did Coffee, Foxy Brown, Switchblade Sisters, Big Birdcage. Obviously, he's worked with Pam Grier a bit. Big Dollhouse also has Pam Grier. And of course, a certain time and place, like women in prison movie in the 70s, you're going to get the titillation you're probably not going to get in something like Immaculate. And that's there and present. But there's also like a lot of stuff that like kind of undercuts it in a way. I mean, there is like not really undercutting it because it's just like there are like breasts for people who want to see, who are going to see this movie to see Pam Grier's breasts. But then also the characters in the movie that are trying to take advantage of the women, you get a lot of like the perspective, the scenes where it's like them in the shower that men are going to leer at. There are the male characters leering at them and then being taken advantage of by the female prisoners. And one of the guards in this is an amazing performance by Sid Haig. Ooh. And Jack Hill apparently is the guy who discovered Sid Haig.
Wow.
And like, I think Sid Haig and Pam Grier's performances alone really elevate it and make it fun, because there's like in 70s exploitation movies, sometimes there are things that like I feel like Tarantino talks about a lot, where it's like, oh man, this is the best movie ever, like just really heaping on immense praise, and then you watch it and it's just like the most like standard setups of all time. Yeah. And it's not like all that phenomenal. There's like maybe a handful of interesting things, and that was kind of where The Big Dollhouse fell for me. But Haig and Pam Grier's performance were really fun. Like, Sid Haig's character is like kind of, it feels like a staple in the women in prison genre. It's like a guy who is really excited and explicit about raping the female prisoners. Like, he talks
the
about
rapist.
Rape. Yeah, the like, but it's just like a gleeful rapist. Like, oh boy, I sure can't wait to get to raping him. Like, that kind of character. And like, Haig delivers that with just like such glee and evil that it's like so ridiculous and funny. Like, the ultimately, what it kind of builds up to the end when Grier and some, who like her character's name is also just Grier, but when her and some other like female prisoners wind up escaping, they turn Haig on like one of the female guards that was actually controlling them, and the movie sort of ends with him like joyously raping the female villain while the women get away. And it's just like that type of like insane, like poor taste stuff that you cannot ever replicate again today. Nor would I really advocate for like anyone trying to make something like that. But like, it's a crazy movie. And like, despite, I don't know, some weakness, some zone out, it, I don't know, just a fun, crazy movie shot in the Philippines.
You convinced me. I'm watching it. no, it's, I mean, to be honest, you know, that is, it's very upsetting, but it is like that, that like, that is a good escape plan. You know what I mean? Send in the horny rapist guard on the other guards. It's a good escape plan. It just is.
Every movie has a life lesson in it. That's the thing. Like, you know, you forget where you come from, and you forget that when you learned about how to read stories and analyze stories, in middle school and high school, even elementary school, you were asked what the moral of the story was, you know, and like, what did you take away from this about human nature? That was always in English class. They were like, what does this story say about human nature? And sometimes that's all you need to take away about human nature from a movie. It's like one little tip and a trick, maybe, for if you were to find yourself in a similar situation.
A tip, yeah. That's
a tip and a trick.
People are always like, you know, a great movie is like three great scenes and no bad ones. To me, a good movie is a tip and a trick. You know what I mean? And if I'm leaving the movie with that, at least I have a little bit more than in which I came in. Yeah,
some
in
knowledge
with.
In your back pocket.
Yeah. Take that, Howard Hawks.
Every movie's like a lemon, and you could get some juice, you know, some value. You know what I mean? If you're not squeezing some juice, some lessons out of the movie, that's a waste of time. You could have been more productive with your time.
That's why I think Martin Scorsese's best movie is his 45-minute contribution to New York Stories, which is called Life Lessons, because it's only 45 minutes and you get life lessons the whole time.
Get your notepad out. What else can you ask for?
It's like, that's the most efficient movie of all time. Usually you have to sit through these 3-hour Scorsese movies waiting for the moral of the story to kick in, you know?
And usually it's the same, that crime is bad. Like, that's why.
Sometimes it almost convinces me, though, and then it pulls the rug
at
the last
second. Whoa.
These guys ever get away with it, you know? Come on. What about a story about those guys?
The Schindler of crime, who sets free all of the people.
That would be a good movie, to be honest.
Yeah, of course. Well, of course,
I could have robbed one more.
Yeah, I could have saved one more criminal from going to jail. Last time we recorded,
yes.
Oh, were you gonna?
I was gonna ask if you've seen anything good or bad.
Well, it's funny that you should ask because I have seen both.
Okay.
Last time we recorded, I kind of shuttled you guys out of here when we finished recording because I had to go, right? I had to be quick. Well, I didn't shuttle JT out of here, technically. I left him behind to feed my cat because I went out of town. So I went to New York, and among other things, I did watch a movie in New York. I went there initially for my lovely fiance's DJ set. DJ Kerosene was playing at Doris, per usual, in Bed-Stuy. But I also, when I was there, checked out the inaugural Amnesia Scope. This is a friend of the podcast, Nick Newman's new film series over at the Brooklyn Theater Research Center. So I went over there, right? And I was very much in a rush, and it was nice to like finally sit down and relax for once, because driving from Philly to New York, I finally get to this weird warehouse, and it's like, well, this isn't a movie theater. This is more of an art space. This is what Malcolm's talked about on the show.
Fear of microcinemas.
The fear of microcinemas. Now, I know that my good friend, Nick Newman, good friend of the podcast, would never steer me wrong. So, you know, if it wasn't for him, I may have gotten back in my car and turned around. My little rental car, and drove back down to the other side of Brooklyn. Maybe gotten to something at Film Forum or something like that. I think that's in Manhattan, but play along with me here. So I get into the door, and the guy at the door is like, "Are you here for the movie or the LSD?"
Oh,
okay. So it turns out,
can it be both?
Yeah, exactly. It turns out this Brooklyn Center for Theatrical Research is like a two-story theater / arts space. And you know, whenever a venue is called a space, that some chicanery is going down, you know? So apparently the top floor, there was like an LSD rave type event going on with like tribal music playing. So they were like, yeah, if you want to go upstairs, you know? And I was like, oh, I'm good, but interesting. So I got on the patio, and I'm just like taking pictures of the skyline like a tourist, because it was a very beautiful view, frankly. And then, you know, I see some people come into the lobby. I'm like, oh, you're here for the screening too? And they're like, no. I'm like, nice. But it was weird how they were like, it seemed really intense. Like everyone that came out of there was like sweating and like gripping a water bottle, you know, and like the tribal music playing and stuff like that. I was like, damn, they're really going all in. I guess that's what New York theater is like these days. But I did then settle in for the inaugural Amnesia Scope, and Nick Newman did a great job introducing his mystery selection for the night, which was my first film by Jean-Claude Brissot. I saw A Brutal Game, which is a film that I believe Malcolm has talked about on a middle segment like this before, but
yes.
Seeing A Brutal Game in a kind of loft micro theater space with 20 other people cramped in there and, you know, people on hallucinogens listening to loud tribal music 10 feet above you, slowly kind of sinking into the theater, the noises, and maybe even the sweat and vibes. It was a very unnerving experience. And I think Nick, even if he didn't know that there was going to be a bleed situation, programmed a good one for that, because that is a dark movie, man. That is a fucked up movie that keeps you on edge the whole time, despite its beautiful art house stylings. It is a very brutal movie, a very violent movie about a man who handicaps a woman and then kind of helps her out afterwards, but also continues to abuse her. When I say woman, she was a young girl at the time of the incident in the beginning of the film. And I think that Jean-Claude Brissot is a filmmaker that we need to talk about on the podcast, because Malcolm's seen one or two, right?
Yeah.
And JT, have you seen anything by him?
I haven't seen any.
But I know you've investigated the field, perhaps. Like you've looked into this filmmaker or heard of him.
I've looked into the field.
I've looked into the field as well. Apparently, he's done some very bad things reflected upon the content of his movies. And so, you know, that is a twisted mind. But anyway, I thought I'd just talk about the theatrical experience, which was interesting, more so than the movie, which was great, but kind of hard to remember. Anyway, I did think that it was very much akin to, like, Godard's 80s work in a way. Like, it's a bridge between, like, post-New Wave Godard, or really post-Ziga Vertov group Godard, and, like, Michael Haneke and filmmakers like that, like the more, like, 90s into the 2000s Euro kind of harsher artsy filmmakers, and bridges the gap quite well. And maybe even a dose of the more extreme genre guys, like Jean Rollin or something like that. Jean Rollin! Anyway, A Brutal Game's great, but shout out to Nick Newman for doing his thing. Definitely go to the next one of those, because whatever mystery movie he picks will be great. So yeah, I think that's going to do it for this week's extended clip, unless you guys have anything else to shout out here.
Disclaimer, the LSD stuff that Eddie was talking about, they're not taking actual drugs. It's all fake. Anyone listening?
Oh, yeah. I guess maybe that's bad to talk about on a podcast, but I don't know.
It's just, you don't have to worry, because they're not actually doing it. You know, it was a lie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the play. That was probably, you know what? Yeah. Maybe, honestly, and this is not even me trying to cover, now that I realized I just like said the name of a place and that they were doing drugs there. In all honesty, like, that may have been the immersive experience, was like, you go in there and it's like everyone's acting like they're tripping, you know? And then you are just like, whoa, this place is crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And then they give you just like a sugar tablet or something. And you're just like, well, I don't feel anything. Oh, wait, that's the theater.
It's a placebo.
That is the immersive experience, because downtown theater is pretty crazy. I don't know if you remember that movie we talked about, Slow Machine. There's some avant-garde stuff going down there. So I would not be surprised if the quote-unquote, are you here for the acid thing, was part of a grand performance happening on top of that cinematic performance. Anyway, A Brutal Game. Check it out. You can always email us at extendedclippodcast@gmail.com. And you can always subscribe to the Patreon for $5 a month to get an extra episode every week. Our last Patreon episode was on Yearning by Mikio Naruse. in our next Patreon episode is going to be on A Serious Man by the Coen brothers. Oh, one more thing about that micro cinema screening. So these guys that I sat next to, they didn't even know Nick or anything. Like, I think they just knew maybe the guy who ran the theater venue or something.
Mm-hmm.
They start trying to make small talk with me, right? And then when I say I'm from LA, they're like, wait, what part of LA? I said the Valley. And they both, like, their eyes light up. And it turns out that the two guys next to me attended the two high schools in the Valley I went to.
Wow.
But I really thought they were, like, putting me on. Like, they were part of the theater group or something.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
No, because I was legitimately like, list some names of people you knew. And they were just like, oh, did you know? And they just list all these people. I'm like, I have
Eddie's
no
clue. Being gang stalked.
Yeah, I was like, I have no clue who these people are. And then they finally mentioned a guy I knew, and I was like, oh, shit, yeah. And they texted him, and they texted that guy like, hey, do you remember Eddie Averill? The guy texts back like, first ... WTF question, like, why? And I was like, all right, that proves that we know each other. I'm leaving. I don't need to see what your good friend who I knew in high school thinks of me.
Can't let your old reputation catch up with your new one, you know?
I guess so. Well, it's probably the same reputation, just like in different places. It's kind of like Dalton from Roadhouse.
Hell yeah. That's sick.
He ripped a guy's throat out of Oh, Eddie, I hear you ripped a guy's throat out at New Beverly. They said it was in self-defense, though.
You have more of the reputation of the My Bodyguard kid.
Yeah, I heard he shot a kid through the eyeball. All right. I'm not going to talk about what that guy supposedly did to teachers. I don't think Ricky Linderman could have possibly harmed a teacher. Come on. He's pure of heart.
It's more that Matt Dillon character you had to watch out for.
Yeah, Moody was all schmoozing up on that teacher. It was, creepy.
Little Apple play.
Yeah, he was trying to get a little fucking, you know, what's it called? May-December action. Anyway, bye.